What is the deal with that Woody Woodpecker tattoo? Why is Randall Tex Cobb there? Why does the movie end with Nicolas Cage seeing that Randall Tex Cobb has the same Woody Woodpecker tattoo that he does? It all makes sense to us on an emotional level. It all makes sense to us on an intuitive level, just like our cat here, who is scratching up that chair. He's a very bad kitty. And we're back. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Crowded Theater Podcast. As always, I am Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Cliff.
Yeah, we have a good one this week. We ended up seeing a screening of, first of all, how rude of me, how are you guys? How has your week been? Taylor, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing good. I'm glad now that we're finally recording. It's a bit of a gray day in Austin today. But, you know, the sun will come out later on this afternoon. Cliff, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing awesome.
Kick ass.
Got my green tea and my Serious Gourmet shit mug. From the Alamo Draft House, which is what it's supposed to be for.
Perfect, 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 perfect. Anyway, so we ended up, to kind of cleanse the palate from our the somewhat disappointing experience that was Mickey 17 last week, we rejoiced when we saw that there was going to be a screening at the AFS Theater, the Austin Film Society Theater, of Raising Arizona, which is playing as part of their Something Something series right now. And Raising Arizona, the second film by the Coen brothers, and one that was hugely inspirational and influential and just a beloved film for Cliff and me from sort of adolescence to today. I feel like, it's funny, I was watching Primus audition drummers earlier today for the new Primus band. I feel like everyone right around 13 years old discovers Primus and Raising Arizona. Because, Raising Arizona came out in 1987, okay? Coen Brothers, Raising Arizona. I was 2, and yet you don't really tune into the energy of Primus or Raising Arizona until you're about junior high age, and you start getting into, weird stuff, and then all of a sudden everyone locks in at that point. Because I noticed every time there was a Primus drummer, no matter what age, whether he was born in the 90s or born in the 60s, every one of these guys who was saying they were a huge fan of Primus, they always said they had been a fan of Primus since they were 13 years old. So I think that that's just one of those things. Everyone locks in. This feels, it very much has a 13-year-old boy energy, and I am a fan. I did an entire podcast about Robert Zemeckis, so I'm a big fan of 13-year-old boy energy in movies, and I think we have that in its most sophisticated and thematically resonant form. Taylor, since you were never a 13-year-old boy, as far as we know, when did you tune in to Raising Arizona?
When you showed it to me at some point earlier in our relationship, I think in our living room and whatnot. Yes. But it was you who introduced me to the movie.
That, I think, is probably the corresponding feminine side of the coin, is that all boys tune into Raising Arizona and Primus at the age of 13, and all girls tune in to Raising Arizona when their boyfriend then shows them Raising Arizona at some point. And I felt like it was a lot of boyfriend showing their girlfriend Raising Arizona energy in the theater. It was a remark to talk about the theater for a minute.
A whole wide variety of ages, yes, and types of people, and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Played like gangbusters. Go ahead.
Oh, and the real gift was there was an entire row of like high school-ish age boys that were there with someone's mother supervising it right in the row right in front of us. So they were the prime age to be receptive to all of the goodness.
Yeah, you were close to them.
On.
How did they respond to the movie? Were you tuning in at
all? I think they were tuned in. Yeah, they were laughing at all the funny parts and all that good stuff. And the whole, what was fun is that the entire theater of this diverse group of people of every kind of age and all that was just tuned in to this movie from beginning to end, laughing at every gag, didn't really feel the energy lag at any point. And that's testament. That just works in a universal way.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because we talked about how like certain movies, when they play, especially at your city's indie theater, like Mulholland Drive being another one, people turn up for it because it's a good time. Everyone wants to go see it. Film people who are want to go to the indie theater anyway hold it in high esteem, etc. So it was a packed theater, and what was Friday night? Saturday? When did we see it? What time of day did we see it? No, it was Wednesday night.
Wednesday.
It was early.
Wednesday night. But packed theater, and I noted just, it was a wide array of people. Mm-hmm. Unlike when you, like, you go to a PAX screening at AFS with your girlfriend of a Miyazaki movie, and it's a packed screening, but everyone's kind of tuned into a very specific wavelength. Maybe Miyazaki's the wrong thing.
I was going to say, that was maybe
almost like
wrong.
Something slightly gayer that's like anime. I don't know. But everyone's kind of the same age. Like, you
there's
go see,
also film bro-y movies that people totally come out. Are. You don't have to go for the anime
there
nerds.
There totally are. They generally don't get programmed at indie film theaters,
but
those things totally do exist. No, absolutely. But
where's Fight Club playing? Coming up.
Nowhere. That's the crazy thing.
No, weren't we talking about...
We were talking about how Fight Club plays nowhere.
Oh, okay.
You know,
boo,
and that's, so that's, yeah, because they're okay, not... That's, okay, that's okay. Not getting programmed at DFS anytime soon, I'll tell you that.
Maybe at a Draft House, remember 99
yes.
series.
Yeah, if the Draft House does a 99 series, they got to do that. Or, you know, Fincher comes out with one of his good ones, you know, every third or fourth film, and then so suddenly, you know, they're doing a retrospective or something, and maybe they'll do it. I don't know. Sorry, what were we just talking about a moment ago that led to all of that? The screening itself. Raising Arizona, by contrast to the oft occurring Miyazaki
niche
screening
groups.
Or the totally hypothetical Fight Club screening that, you know, we're still waiting on. As opposed to those two things, there was a remarkable diversity of ages and just different group types of people filling out that theater. We saw old gray hair people there who were coming to see a fun movie they remember mm-hmm. from the mm-hmm. 80s. There was obviously us who had grown up on it. There were, as Cliff said, a whole young generation there. There were dates there. It's just one of those movies, and I think the reason it's relevant to bring up is not just because, again, to remind the audience, the Crowded Theater Podcast is the only podcast where we do not watch movies on DVD, we do not watch them on streaming or even VHS. We watch them only in the theater, among a crowded theater full of people. Our cat just meowed. And so the theater tells the truth, and that's the thing, is that especially when you have a diverse group of people, different ages, all packed in, individuating into a sort of mass collective consciousness, you can kind of really feel what a movie can do. And a movie like Raising Arizona, 1987 to today, still packing people in, which is strange for a... What is such... I mean, the Coen brothers have obviously gone on to make a lot of films, and that's raised the value of this film, I'm sure, in the esteem of many people, because they've had such great careers. But still, the film itself is a weird movie, and yet it is something that is sort of universally, transcendently regarded as a transcendent kind of happy, cathartic movie-going experience. Otherwise, why would so many different kinds mm-hmm. of people be there to experience it, and why would it play so well? How did you think it played in front of that audience, babe?
Well, I think it played gangbusters. I think it played really well. I don't think anyone walked out of there unhappy, you know? but yeah, no, it was a good screening. It was a good time. I was just kind of thinking to myself, it feels like one of Nicolas Cage's more underplayed roles. Like, he doesn't have any kind of freak out, you know, Nicolas Cage moment.
I mean, it's interesting. Go ahead, elaborate on that, because I find it very strange, because I think what's interesting, it's funny you say that, because Nicolas Cage at the time, who was kind of a dramatic actor, you know, emerging, it was a very cartoonish and broad performance for him, you know, at the time, with all, very broad performance for him, you know, with all crazy, wacky faces and all that kind of stuff. And so it's interesting that his career, he had to take things to such a level of, like, loudness in all of his performance and just scene-gnawing fucking craziness that no one had ever seen before, for us to now look at Raising Arizona, where he basically plays Wile E. Coyote, and it's like, it's actually one of his more subtle and nuanced performances. Because you're right. You're not wrong. You're absolutely right. But isn't that wild? Who saw that coming? Who saw that that's where that was going to go? That we would look at that and, like, relative to bees or whatever
the
fucking... Yeah, or like that Mandy shot that everyone sort of gifs over and over again of him chugging whiskey covered in blood in his underwear going, ah! Like, you know, I mean, relative to that.
You know, yeah. For sure. But I think it does speak to some part of the method of how this was made, because kind of famously the Coen brothers and Nicolas Cage didn't get along on this production and never worked together again.
Oh, yes,
and that
was
because Nicolas Cage was, as he's known for today, famous for just kind of making shit up on set and going wild. Yeah. Whereas the Coen brothers, though they had to get a very broad performance from him, it was a very specific broad performance. It had to be very specific in every single shot. Yeah. in order for the thing to work. And yeah, they just can't let him feel the space and kind of.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the other thing I think is also, I think that you can probably look back for just historically, is you see a young Nicolas Cage who's very young and trying to establish himself as an actor. And you have the Coens, who no one has seen a Coen Brothers movie. I mean, everyone's seen Blood Simple, but no one's seen anything like this. So it's interesting that. It's sad that they didn't ever work together again, because you just advance 10 years and Nicolas Cage has the confidence in the Coen brothers that other actors would later just, you know, throw. I mean, fucking Javier Bardem's putting on silly Dutch boy wigs in a very serious Western movie, and he's like, well, it's the fucking Coen brothers. They fucking know what they're doing, I guess. And all of the other insane shit that they're doing. And then a few years later, you know, Nicolas Cage is also confident in a place in his career where the Coen brothers can kind of invest in that persona, in his wild manness and all of that. And you could see that they would work really well together. But well, I think the Coen brothers were in their early 30s when they made this. Nicolas Cage was quite young. So, but, you know, that's why Ships in the Night, we only have this precious object, the only thing that brings together the insanity of the Coen brothers with the... truly singular insanity of Nicolas Cage in one movie. So it is also tough to talk about Raising Arizona and talk about the Coen brothers and the inception of their career and what that film meant without also talking about Sam Raimi and talking about Evil Dead 2. So I think before we get into all the things that make this film great, we should give a little bit of context. I was recently saw a clip with Quentin Tarantino talking about his experience being a young film geek, seeing Raising Arizona and seeing Evil Dead 2 and seeing Crime Wave in between, which we'll get to. That at the time, seeing it was so exciting, you know, everything from the wide lenses going along everywhere to the little miniature bridge, you know, in Evil Dead 2, to all of that energy and that sort of boyish enthusiasm that you can kind of, exuberance you can kind of feel coming through the camera as it's racing around. He said that it made everything else feel obsolete to young film fans. It made everything else feel old-fashioned. And while various critics were huffing and puffing about, you know, I wonder what will happen when they make a real movie one day, you know, for young film fans, they thought, well, there's no reason to shoot anything any other way but this forever. And what's interesting is that's the experience he had in 1987. And I can recall when we were on the set of our first movie many, many years ago, it was exactly the same conversation. We were all talking about Raising Arizona and Evil Dead 2, and we were all trying to put wide lenses on cameras and rush up in people's faces and do crazy whip pans and all of that same shit. And again, I was born in 85, so, you know, we weren't in film school until the early 2000s. And yet, Sam Raimi, we should talk about this more on a Sam Raimi episode, but you almost can't put into perspective how influential Sam Raimi is when you not look at just what he and his competition with the Coen brothers created, and then all of the thousand ships that launched, from Peter Jackson and Dead Alive to, you know, up Sam Raimi eventually directing Spider-Man. It's like he, in a subtle way, is probably the most influential director, most influential kind of cinematic voice of the last, you know, 40 or so years in cinema. Certainly, he has, you know...
Kind of dropped off with Doctor Strange, but until that point.
I know, but that's the thing, is that Doctor Strange and the, what is it called?
The Multiverse of Madness.
I'd like to rewatch it. I remember enjoying it.
And The Witch Shoots Lasers.
The Witch Shoots Lasers, yes. That is the one thing that her witchery involved a lot of shooting lasers out of her hands. But anyway, we'll revisit that at some point. But I don't know. What is interesting is Evil Dead 2 has many things that connect it to Raising Arizona. One of those things being that Holly Hunter, who was, of course, launched into stardom by this movie and would a few years later be getting an Academy Award for Broadcast News, was Sam Raimi's first choice to play the female lead, you know, the girl who gets, you know, the professor's daughter in Evil Dead 2. And it is wild to imagine what Evil Dead... The two films are shot so similarly and even have, you know, parallel shots like rushing over the cars and everything like that, that they're... to imagine a world in which those films are so connected by even having Holly Hunter in both films, and it is wild.
I'd like to peer my head into that multiverse and see what that one looks like.
I know,
like,
that multiverse of madness would be a hell of a thing to go to get into. Good call. But it's also wild to just think about just what Evil Dead 2 would be, completely transformed by Holly Hunter's performance, which, as good as I don't know her name, who was played the female professor's daughter and all that kind of stuff, as great as she is in that movie, Holly Hunter would have taken it to an entirely different level because she is Holly Hunter, and you see that on display in this film. And boy howdy, as much as we talk about the craziness of Nicolas Cage, the biggest reactions, the things that simultaneously are the most cartoonishly funny and the things that ground the movie dramatically in a way that actually allows us to feel safe investing in it emotionally, all come from Holly Hunter. It is one of the most bravura performances given by any actress in any movie ever. I can say that unreservedly without hyperbole, just because it would be one thing for her to just take this, all of the insanity, even Nicolas Cage's kind of odd half-commitment, though he does very well with the high, and take all of this cartoonish reality and just be a goofball the whole time. Mm-hmm. It would be one thing if she did that. It would be one thing if she did that and managed to ground us in actually caring, believing that she actually is, somehow in a way that works in the rest of this movie, a woman who desperately wants to have children, who now can't have children, and like sobbing her way through that scene, which obviously very, 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 very much was a direct influence on the first 20 minutes of Up, which your generation grew up with, even some similar shots of them, and especially the long pre-title sequence as well. But anyway, being able to ground us in that drama amidst all of this cartoonishness would be a feat enough. That would be incredible enough. And yet, that's not where the performance ends. The performance ends in that she has to now channel all of that through, like, one of the most authentic and, like, grounded and best Southern accents ever committed to screen, that feels not like some put-on fucking plantation owner. And I know I believe Holly Hunter is from the South, I think. I should have looked that up. I always just assumed she was from the South. I think she is, because of this movie. And it turns out she's from Australia. She's not, actually. She's American. I just made that up. But no, the point is, through that accent, through all of the... I mean, she just gets some of the biggest laughs in the movie. She is the heart of the movie. She somehow pulls all of this silliness when these scenes that especially as young men, who we loved John Goodman being insane and Nicolas Cage being insane and then them all going rah! The whole time. But we wouldn't revisit the movie. We wouldn't see it over and over again. We wouldn't feel anything by the end of this movie if it wasn't for Holly Hunter being able to somehow alchematize all of her insane lines, the insane motivations of her character to want to kidnap a baby, which is a whole thing to talk about, you know, in the plot, is a crazy jumping off point for a movie. Take all of that and somehow alchematize that into someone who you just fall in love with on screen and has so much screen presence and charisma, and there are moments when in 1 second she's it's a wild car chase, and the next moment she's just being very, that moment like where she's singing to the baby in the morning is just so authentic and sweet, and I don't know, it is the emotional lens that focuses everything else is sort of in satellite, in orbit around that the whole time, that sort of centerpiece. Anyway, can talk about Holly Hunter all day and stuff, but let's talk about Raising Arizona, guys. It's a good movie. Taylor, Raising Arizona.
This time watching it, I mean, it's a great movie. It's a fun time. It's a good ride. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to speak against the podcast, but even at home, go check it out. Like, it is a great time. Go see it in a theater, though. They always have great screenings. Yeah. But it is just one of those great rides, good vibes, good happily ever after, in a way. type of vibes. But I was actually thinking about the opening scene, which mm-hmm. I think is very fun and original. And I am just surprised that you don't see that setup for other movies. You know, the opening credits right before you get to the opening scene is basically their love story of how they fell in love mm-hmm. through this criminal and officer. And the same criminal constantly getting booked and having to get his picture taken. And she mm-hmm. happens to be the officer that takes the photo. And, mm-hmm. you know, she's in a relationship at first. And then they get broken up with. And then he comes in and as a free man proposes. And it's this kind of like this quick love story mm-hmm. again. Very Up-like kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very surprised that you don't see a similar setup. Or maybe that mm-hmm. take that into a plot of something else. Like, it seems very rom-com book like mm-hmm. I feel like that could be very funny and again so much comedic value but I feel like it's the only tell me that I'm wrong, but I feel like it's the only story that has even that element in it, you know, 100%. Let alone as an opening scene.
No, I agree. I think that one of the amazing things about that is it's what makes the film such a fun and easily
right into it.
Exactly, is that you know that when you hit play on the movie, you're essentially going to be thrust kind of like that roller coaster that's not a slow build but one of those ones that sort of launches you right away. Like the Mr. Freeze at Six Flags. It's like a slingshot
mm-hmm.
when you start the movie. And what's nice about it is it makes up so much ground. It tells through this very simple story that is essentially just the mugshots, the prison, and then eventually going to their trailer at the end to see their domestic situation form in, you know, 10 minutes of screen time. I forget how long it is, 15 minutes of screen time. We get super invested in this relationship. We feel like we've surveyed a history, a large portion of time with them. And then once we get through the renewal of the Raising Arizona title coming up, you know, we're already deep into what would be, you know, the first act of the movie. We're deep into what would the caper is underway, mm-hmm. and it creates so much more real estate than within the film for them to have fun and indulge in the extended car chase sequences, like the extended mm-hmm. car chase sequence, yeah. and all the shit with Randall Tex Cobb and
was the one disappointing thing about the row of high school students in front of me right at the beginning of the chase scene.
Uh-huh.
One of them went up to go get concessions. It's like, dude, this is the scene. This is your favorite scene.
This is
your
favorite
scene.
Sit
down and watch it, man.
You got to check it out. No, that's...
There's no plot in it that's super crucial.
No.
But it's what the movie's... You know, it's these things the movie's built around.
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. No, and that... I don't know. That whole thing with... what is it? That crazy high bluegrass music playing over it is wild and energetic, and I think what's really appealing to young boys especially about this movie is it just feels indulgent in the best way, indulgent in pure sort of fun and having fun with what cinema is and having fun with what a camera can do. And it feels like running around with your friends playing tag or something
mm-hmm.
like that. I mean, it really does. Even I remember Barry Sonnenfeld, the director of RV, one of Taylor's favorite films, who shot Raising Arizona, talking about we should also mention Sonnenfeld because as a director, he then brought some of that surreal Coen Brothers-y wide-angled lens-ness into the 90s with the Addams Family movies and Men in Black, which he also directed, and a bunch of shit. He brought this aesthetic into the mainstream, but he was a big part when working with the Coen Brothers of shooting everything, and if you look at the early interviews, very wide lenses and keeping the camera that dynamic. And the literal words he used is he said, I think of a wide lens says, hey, let's go have fun with this guy. And like, and that's exactly what it does. It gives you that immediate sense of presence, and the camera just rushes up to you like an enthusiastic child and says, hey, let's go have fun with this guy. And there's something about that enthusiasm that was so contagious. I can remember us with cameras and shit in Richard's apartment shooting scenes for our early, you know, shorts and movies, and just trying to basically use wide lenses to say, hey, come on, let's go have fun with this guy. And the language in which that manifested itself was camera whips and Russians and all of this kind of stuff that we, you know, were just ripping off from Sam Raimi and from the Coen brothers. I don't know. So I guess to get back on track here, I love I love the opening sequence for so many reasons, and one of the reasons is it just creates so much room for us to now just have fun. It creates so much room for so much of the movie to be the fun and games of that movie. And even the somewhat abstract ending and all the dream sequences, you know, and not having a lot of plot that has to resolve itself. You feel like the whole movie is dessert, you know, with no vegetables, and yet it still feels emotionally satisfying at the end. It's fantastic. But what is this film, Cliff? What else? What does this film mean, Cliff?
Well, it's a...
Why? What, it's on a deeper level. What is it?
On a deeper level, it's... I don't know if a deeper level. It's a Looney Tunes cartoon brought
that
to life.
That is true.
He has a Woody Woodpecker tattoo on him, just in case you're
that is
confused
true.
About that.
That is true.
An unacknowledged matching tattoo is in this movie that no one really points out. That
it's pointed out a lot.
Well, you mean the one on Random Sex Cops?
Yeah,
shirts?
I don't feel like
that
I...
the biker has
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
I don't
well,
think
that's the whole like
spoke
meme.
About it.
Well, they don't. No one speaks.
Okay,
about
that's what
it,
I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Non-verbally acknowledged.
Gotcha. Film geeks speak about it, but yes, no one in the movie speaks about it.
No, you're
right. Although it is what suddenly he's in, has him in the bear hug, and as soon as he sees the tattoo and there's recognition, he lets him go.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something there.
Okay.
Some
No, there's, I think, that recognition of, and that's sort of the fun thing to get into it, is that we could talk about, you know, Chuck Jones also, and, you know, obviously Spielberg and Zemeckis and other people were integrating Chuck Jones into cinema, you know, around this same time, and just, and even everything down to, like, when they're at the adoption agency, and, like, the guy they cast to, like, look through their file, you know, literally looks like a Chuck Jones character with his face twisted into sort of a very disapproving look, and it never moves the whole time. We could talk about all that, but what's cool to talk about with Raising Arizona is... what is the deal with that Woody Woodpecker tattoo? What the fuck does any of that mean? Why is Randall Tex Cobb there? Why does the movie end, and it's totally okay with everybody that it ends this way, with Nicolas Cage seeing that Randall Tex Cobb has the same Woody Woodpecker tattoo that he does, then he blows up, then baby shoes that Randall Tex Cobb has on him fall to the ground, and we sort of get it, and then he has a dream about future children he might have. It all makes sense to us on an emotional level. It all makes sense to us on an intuitive level, just like our cat here, who is scratching up that chair. He's a very bad kitty. it all makes sense to us on an intuitive level. So as wacky and abstract as it is one thing to talk... let me put it this way. There are other films we could mention that attempt to be cartoons. You know, there are other films by other directors that attempt to... I mean, even... I love Joe Dante, you know, but even a film like The Burbs, which kind of attempts in certain ways to be a cartoon, doesn't really... has not had the staying power of a film like Raising Arizona. So on some level, it being a cartoon in execution is one of the amazing things that makes it so compulsively rewatchable, and sort of was, you know, foretold how transcendently singular the Coen brothers' career was going to be after this. Sure. But it is the emotional story making sense. And why does it make sense that makes us go back to the theater and want to watch it over and over again and all of that other bullshit? And it's interesting because when you start to parse up, like, what is the emotional story of this movie? You also start to have to think about questions like, why is this film called Raising Arizona? Why does the narration sound like it is pulled from a dusty old Western paperback, etc., etc., etc.? Why does it take place in this desert? And at its simplest level, if you were to try and reduce Raising Arizona to just like a concept or an idea, it's something that portrays the contemporary idea of just becoming a dad, the contemporary idea of just getting married, starting up a domestic situation and all of that, as a Western. It does this not by setting it in the Old West or anything like that, but taking a Western and forcing it into a contemporary scenario where all of the drama of merely, in this way, it's similar to a film like Eraserhead, which turns the idea of having a baby, meeting a girl and having a baby, into a surreal and horrific nightmare. This film takes the idea of meeting a girl and having a baby into a incredibly highly dramatic romantic western with all full of all of its beauty and all of its terror and all of its strong black hat white hat sort of issues of honor and manhood and how those polarities have to be fought out. In this film, it's, you know, being an outlaw versus being a good boy and coming back in, all of that kind of stuff. Because I like one of the things I heard, you know, the Coen brothers say years ago, and I think it's just relevant to bring up now, is they said that they, not unlike Spielberg and some of the others, grew up on TV. And so they would see movies in the context of seeing really lowbrow westerns in black and white and really highbrow cinema made by some of the greatest masters in cinema in black and white back to back with very little discernment between those two things. You know, and so it was just wild to see them all mixed up, and it was, they were all just movies. What's crazy about this movie is that it is a Looney Tunes cartoon and it is all of these things, but what it's even its conceit, even the fact that it exists at all, speaks to the Coens intuitively or intellectually at the time understanding on a deep level what is a Western, what is a Western trying to do emotionally and thematically, and why are Westerns, say, relevant to a guy like Nicolas Cage, who might be a dad, maybe not a real outlaw, but maybe just a dad who's having a baby and, you know, going into a suburban life, leaving his single life behind, etc., etc., to settle down for the first time, to have a baby. Why do Westerns, in the kind of perennial sense, resonate with dads and dad energy? Why did our dad like Westerns? And it uses that to synthesize this insane concept for a movie where I'll tell you what Westerns are about. It's that famous shot at the end of The Searchers. Taylor, you've seen The Searchers. We saw The Searchers in 70mm at the Paramount, didn't we? You came with me to see The Searchers, I believe. The John Wayne movie? See, it made a huge and indelible impression on Taylor.
Tell me more about the movie.
No, it was a John
title.
Wayne movie. Cliff was out of town, I think, was the only reason you got shanghaied into going to see it, because I'm like, I'm not missing The Searchers on 70mm at the Paramount to talk about another crowded theater experience. So I dragged you along. It's in a desert. It's all very in color. John Wayne is in it. Anyway, it was a long time
Boo!
Ago.
Okay,
anyway.
I'm sorry.
Gotta be the only John Wayne movie you've seen in the theater. Come on.
Probably.
Anyway, it would help if I could picture John
yes,
Wayne.
Yes, this.
Oh, right. Okay.
Good call. Good
There's
call.
Our
I'm so
There's
sorry.
Our problem right
anyway.
There. All right.
But not unlike when I saw The Searchers in 70mm, alone, apparently. Not unlike that. What does that last shot mean? Why is it iconic? Why is it iconic that we see Ethan standing silhouetted in that black doorway, and we see behind him the entire West, the rugged potentiality of the desert, very similar to the desert that we're going to see in Raising Arizona, and he stands outside of that door, considers coming back into the home, the hearth, just like the home that...
Oh,
every...
it's tickling my memory.
Oh, you're starting to remember.
I want to.
Why does he not come back in? He does not come back in. He heads back out into the raw potentiality of the desert. All Westerns are essentially about contemporary men making the decision whether or not to settle down. You know, it's like all Westerns are about that idea that when you are young, you have this tremendous desire to focus entirely on the external world, on conquest, on manifestation, on your career, basically, on work, on doing great things, accomplishments, all of that other kind of shit. And then at some point, there is this siren call, this call back to the hearth, back to the fire, back to the home, that says you don't need to keep striving out there on your own. You can come home. You can come home to the hearth. You can come home to the fire, but in a new way, where you will settle down with this woman, you will have children, etc., etc., etc. That is the thing that Ethan cannot do, but it is the thing that Ethan saves for everyone else, the ability to do at the end of The Searchers. In The Outlaw Josie Wales, he loses his family at the beginning, and then over the course of the film slowly builds up a surrogate family around him, etc., etc., and then has to defend them around against, along with the Comanche, against the Union Army at the end of Outlaw Josie Wales. So
Comanche are the bad guys and the Searchers, and they're the good guys in Outlaw Josie Wales.
Exactly. It's pretty cool.
They're both sides. They play all sides, man.
So if every Western, on some level, is about the, you know, that tension between to remain, and the same things with stories about sailors and the many metaphors about the sea are similar to the metaphors of, about the West. If there is this masculine idea of what is it to be a man? Why is it at some point in order to be a man it involves proving one's bravery and heading out into the West and heading out to conquest and heading out as an atomized individual with other men to war or to the West or out upon the sea? And then at what point does that call turn, and being a man involves knowing when to hang up one's spurs and return to the home and actually stay by the side of a woman and have a baby and all of that. And this is played out in Western after Western after Western, and despite the fact that most men in contemporary 20th century America who were reading Western paperback novels and who were watching Western TV shows and going to the cinemas and seeing Westerns were not themselves going on cattle drives and were not themselves, well, aside from World War II, launching out to sea and were not themselves doing many of these things, the metaphor was obviously very, very, very resonant, because in a contemporary context, and what it, Raising Arizona is attempting to update that, in a contemporary context, for most men, that is the desire to be single, to be to fuck a bunch of women, to focus on career to the exclusion of having a family, to focus on using one's money to buy oneself lots of possessions as opposed to using it to provide for the next generation, etc., etc. At what point does the call to being a man sort of shift to that, and what does it mean, and that tension between those two poles, what does that mean? Between the sort of the feminine energy of the home and the masculine energy of the sort of conquest of nature. You know, if that is every Western, and Westerns are relevant to dads who basically are just working jobs and coming home at a steel punching plant like High is doing in the movie, mm-hmm. or whatever, why is that? And what and how can that be exploited on screen? And that is what is so brilliant about Raising Arizona, is it's essentially there's nothing on screen aside from his explicit outlaw nature, which is the only is how his the Western archetype is sort of brought into this film, is that he's an outlaw and he believes his boy is an outlaw, and you can see a twinkle in his eye, and he has his outlaw friends, his other Western companions, the other outlaw boys who are a member of his gang, mm-hmm. who are going to go around on a, you know, robbing banks and a shooting spree, and they want him to hit the trail with them, and it's the decision, you know, am I a good, am I good enough to stay home and raise Arizona, or am I need to go out and raise hell with the boys, blah, 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 that tension. But it's played out in a contemporary context, and they literalize it to the extent that he really is, in fact, an outlaw. He's not, you know, could... This film would be significantly less dynamic if, and way less interesting, because you see versions of this play out if he was, you know, a guy working a desk job and having, you know, strange ideations about being a Western hero, etc. They make him a blue-collar guy. They make him a contemporary version of a Western archetype. They make him this outlaw guy with his outlaw nature and his outlaw friends, etc., etc., etc. But then, beyond that, the only thing that really informs the literalization, it's not literalized to the extent that he's just buying Huggies and he's just getting an apartment with his kid. Now, they are also stealing a baby. This is an important part of the whole outlaw
and
nature.
And stealing the Huggies.
Who
and
ultimately
the pantyhose that he used over his head. That's
no,
a
absolutely,
small
absolutely. But what makes it a Western is the fact that, like, the narration is bonkers for this movie. Just think about it for a second. It all works, but everything is as dry as a high prairie wind, or, you know, even befouling the sweet desert air that crossed his brow, etc. All of these metaphors and ideas that feel like they're pulled out of, like, really artful Western novels or pulpy Western novels, etc., show that the whole way in which High sees his life, the whole way in which he contextualizes, at least from his POV, who he is, what he is, and what manhood is entirely from the, you know, from the soul POV of a Western, from a of a Western narrator, of a John Wayne-like figure, of a man who needs to be a man, even after he punches out what's his dick for trying to attempts to introduce the contemporary idea of being swingers to him. Mm-hmm. He punches out his boss, and Holly Hunter asks him, what do we do now, or what do we have now, or whatever. And he says, "You have a man for a husband," or whatever his line is. And again, that's what, and that's the dilemma, is he does not know. And he finally, ultimately, briefly, you know, all is lost in the movie, decides that they're better off without him, and that's when he writes that whole letter saying goodbye to her, and he's going to return to his lawless ways. But what it does is, by setting it in the desert and giving it this insane Western narration, you have scenes where, in an utterly contemporary way, you have his boss, and the name of the boss and the name of the actor is escaping me at the moment, who's having this conversation with him about him being kind of stuck in his suburban life, and hey, have you tried swinging? But as they're walking, they have an entire desert vista framed behind them, and giant cactuses with the huge arms behind them. So visually, what we are seeing is an image right out of Howard Hawks' Red River, or especially an image right out of any John Ford movie. We are literally seeing a Western image, and we are hearing Western narration.
The horizon is at the bottom of the frame.
The horizon is at the bottom of the frame, exactly. We are seeing Western imagery. We are seeing Western iconography. We are being hit with Western narration, and yet what we're actually watching is just a guy trying to navigate, a Western guy, a Western hero, if you will, an outlaw, trying to navigate contemporary society where he's forced to wear flip-flops, and there's the other guy has a little sweater on, is like, "We are swingers," as in to swing, and punching him out. And what's wild about the movie is that is what alchemizes the crazy Looney Tunes shit with Holly Hunter's performance, with all of that, is the, and this will sound weird, but it is the capital T truth of the movie, if anything else, is that its themes, its understanding of what a Western is, of what it means to be a man in a contemporary setting, and what the two things have to say about each other, is capital T true. That, like, the dilemma, the way in which a man feels this dilemma between, like, wait, who am I now if now what I have to do is go and punch this card and come home and provide for this baby, and all of the things that were I thought were virtuous and strong about myself previously are a liability now, and there's now I'm expected to express manhood through something else. Again, David Lynch explores similar ideas in Eraserhead, but in a very different cinematic way. What does this mean? What does this transmutation of self mean in this context? Well, it feels a lot like a Western. It feels a lot like the moment where the girl beckons ex-Western hero to please stay a little while longer by the fire. He doesn't need to go out yet again. He could make a nice little life for himself here in this small town, and yada, yada, yada. But at the end of every Western TV episode, and at the end of many a Western, the man rides off, quite famously, always into the sunset, all into the raw potentiality of adventure once again, blah, 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 blah. And so if guys who are in Nicolas Cage's situation are consuming Western novels and identifying with that Western persona, what if we saw that act? Not some in a way that cheapened it, but we saw the act, and again, they're stealing the baby, they're not actually having a baby, he is a literal outlaw, so the Western ideas are literalized to some extent in the movie, but what if we just saw it through the lens, cinematically, of a Western, through the desert, through the narration, all of that? Would it work? Could you make an insane movie like this, and would it actually resonate? And I think, given the fact that we just came from a sold-out screening, or almost sold-out screening the other day, with so many different people of so many different ages, that capital T truth seems to still resonate to this day.
Heck yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree, Taylor?
Yeah.
No. I know I was talking for a long time, but I was really excited about saying all of those things. So.
No, I think it's a movie that really does stand the test of time. I think it's just eccentric enough that it, you know, keeps you focused, and then the real story just comes through the great direction and all of those.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's, and I think that's why you get to stuff that's weird and crazy, like the biker Randall Tex Cobb and all of that. It's like, what allows that?
Who just shoots bunnies for fun?
Shoots bunnies for fun. Exactly. He literally kills the rabbit, which is the traditional idea, the traditional symbol for pregnancy, killing the rabbit, which is also echoed in Basic Instinct when she kills a rabbit right after Glenn Close tells Michael Douglas that she is in fact pregnant. So he gets pregnant. We see this figure emerge wearing baby shoes. We later see his tattoo that says "Mama didn't love me." And the first thing he does on screen is symbolically kill the rabbit, which is both the destruction of the symbol of fertility, breeding like rabbits, or the Alice in Wonderland rabbit, but at the same time, it is also a metaphor for he is the inception of something. He is this dark pregnancy, the fact that it isn't their baby, that they stole someone else's baby, that something is born, some demon is born. And I think everyone, because of how cinematically abstract it is and how abstract the narration is, we accept Randall Tex Cobb in the movie as this insane biker as an abstraction. We kind of think, okay, so this is the surreal part where we see into his head a little bit, but you know, that then bursts from the dream world when he ultimately arrives at Unpainted Arizona and we realize that he is a, you know, bounty hunter named
Leonard. Could be more Western than a bounty hunter?
Exactly, a bounty hunter named Leonard Smalls. And what is, I don't know, his bounty hunter named Leonard Smalls, again, taking those abstractions, that something that abstract, and allowing it to, in a surprising way, narratively literalize when he walks through the doors of Unpainted Arizona, again, just demonstrates this really sophisticated, intuitive understanding of what they're doing. The idea is that they know that you're viewing this as something that's symbolic and just abstract, and they know that they're surprising you when he suddenly shows up and turns out to be a real character. And that's okay, because the character enters as abstraction, and he leaves the movie as abstraction when Nicolas Cage pulls back his vest, and we see the little Woody Woodpecker tattoo on him, and we realize that, of course, just as Nicolas Cage explicitly tells you when he's just a dream at the beginning, that he is that which is unleashed when Mrs. Arizona finds her baby missing. Mm-hmm. He is that idea that whatever lawlessness an outlaw weighs, if either High runs away from home and you know, sort of abdicates the responsibility of fatherhood and remains an outlaw, and or if he continues to continues that outlaw way in little Nathan's life, Nathan Jr.'s life, then he will become Randall Tex Cobb. Like, that is why... I mean, Randall Tex Cobb is Nathan Jr. He is the dark future.
What does the tattoo say? Mama didn't love me or something?
Exactly, yes. There, the tattoo says Mama didn't love me. And he wears the baby shoes and all that. And when we see him blown up at the end, and we see that kind of... that he is... we're talking about in Seven how, you know, all the ideas that show, even though it is not literalized fully, the idea that John Doe is, you know, clearly an aspect of Somerset. He's a piece of Somerset. Mm-hmm. He is the dark, judgmental side of Somerset that envies Mill's normal life that he had himself rejected, blah, blah, blah. Go listen to the Seven episode. The Coen brothers take it a step further. There's no way within the literal narrative of the film, aside from magnificent coincidence, to ground narratively or literally in any way the idea that Randall Tex Cobb would have the same Woody Woodpecker tattoo as he has on his arm, you know? And yet, they do it anyway. They show it to you because he enters the film as a dream. He briefly interacts. He literally, we see his boots walk through sliding glass doors at Unpainted Arizona into this demon walk that is unleashed by them, walks into our world, and he is a demon, catching flies out of the air and all that other kind of stuff. And then we see him walk back purely to potentiality, where at the end we're essentially told, no, he is an abstraction. He is an aspect of Nicolas Cage. He is Nathan Jr. all grown up if they don't ultimately make amends for the things that they have done, blah, 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 blah. And as it turns out, by the end, with his final dream, it is Ian conquering him. When they blow him up, we see the baby's shoes fall, and we see that future for Nathan Jr. If they had kept Nathan Jr., that's what would have happened. High would have gone to prison, you know, or something like, who knows, you know, but if they'd kept Nathan Jr., he would have become Randall Tex Cobb. So that blows up. We see the shoes fall down, and then he has his dream, this new abstraction about the future where Nathan Jr. grows up in a loving home with his real parents, becomes a football star, and then as a kind of divine reward or bounty for their ability to survive this trial and stay together, they themselves will be rewarded with a miraculous conception. Because, and whether it's technology,
and it'll look multiple children.
Yeah, oh no, that, yeah, it looked like multiple children. Whether or not you choose to, you know, that's the idea. Was it the final words from Nathan Arizona? It's like saying that, oh yeah, gotta wait for science to catch up with you, like it did for Florence and me. Caught up with a vengeance. Because obviously a big part, and you're probably kind of too young, but there was like a spate of these sorts of news stories about multiple births, because in the early days of what is now
the Octomom.
Yeah, exactly. But in the early days of what is now IVF, or, you know, fertility treatments, whatever it was, they didn't put in one embryo, or there would be multiple embryos that were all within the woman at the same time. So frequently it would result in twins, triplets, and even occasionally would result in these kind of crazy pregnancies, 5, 6, or even 8 babies. Now, I think they have IVF dialed in now where that doesn't happen as much anymore.
Fun fact, not to cut you off, but I rep a lot of very good Disney Channel original movies. There's a great movie called The Quintuplets, or The Quints. And it's
just like this one.
And it's basically the story of an older, singled child who's like 16 or 17. Their parents suddenly have, I think maybe naturally, or maybe not naturally, I don't remember why, but has 5 kids, and they become a news story. And it's this whole, like, you have 6 kids, not 5, or whatever, you know. And it's a fun story.
Yeah, and it's an idea that was just sort of floating around in the zeitgeist in the 90s. That idea of a family who now has 5 kids all at once, obviously the drama of all of that, and then all of the media buzz around that, and what that would mean, etc. And I think that continued right up until, I think there was a multiple births reality show or something by the time, you know, maybe, in the early 2000s or something. I never watched any of that kind of stuff. I don't know. But, you know, so whether you believe, it's obviously grounding all of this idea and science is catching up with people and enabling them, and maybe High works really hard and he gets a whole bunch of money at his job and then he's able to pay for some sort of scientific treatment. But as far as the film is concerned, they annihilate this demonic potentiality from the film, the idea of Randall Tex Cobb, and are then, he is given a prophetic vision suddenly of their divine reward, which is they will grow old together, they will have children, their children will have children, and you see them around this gigantic table of plenty at the end, surrounded by children and surround, which again, in the context of a John Ford movie and all sorts of other things, is very, very meaningful as well. Because again, aside from what we usually look at as being the iconographic elements of John Ford movies, the big tall desert, Monument Valley, doobie-doos, and the cactuses, and the horizon at the top and bottom of the frame, as the Fablemans reintroduced into the zeitgeist, the other thing that was a critical piece of all of those movies that is conspicuously missing from this one was the big family around a table in The Searchers and all of those movies, and How Green Was My Valley and The Quiet Man. It's like when you enter the home, the Western home, the home in Ireland, there's always scenes devoted to everyone eating around the table as this sign. I mean, it is the value that is being fought for, the value that is being defended. It's the value that even a cool contemporary Western like Outlaw Josie Wales kind of turns on its head, as it's not this familial unit defending itself. It's more of this mismatched, patched together family unit, kind of unlike The Searchers, with you know, an old Indian father, grandfather who he's picked up, and an old racist grandmother from Kansas, and you know, various other surrogate family members, and them who sort of form this family and have to defend themselves against the Union Army at the end. But we finally achieve that image at the end as the kind of spiritual reward for them having to get through all of these things and everything. And there is something, I don't know, there is just something about all that that, again, resonates with the capital T truth of all of that. Not just on the level of, you know, we like seeing that our characters are happy and that they get what they want ultimately, but there is something about casting that dilemma entirely through this prism of all of these Western images, of all these Western ideas, that feels truer than a more literal version of the same story. There are many films that try and capture fatherhood or parenthood just by showing them as they are. No one is a, there's no Western, you know, iconography in the background. There's no abstract, you know, like Zane Grey narration. There's no fucking him being going to prison three times in the first 10 minutes of the movie because he's an outlaw. There's none of that. And yet they feel more distant, less true, and less relatable than High and Ed feel in this movie. It feels less... I mean, again, the movie theater tells the truth. There was a wide array of people in there all resonating on that movie, and it wasn't just because of the crazy, wacky lenses all these years later. And I think it is because, you know, there's something about fiction that is sort of truer than truth, and that is why I think the reference points that a lot of men think about in contemporary society, especially in the 20th century, are Western archetypes. Honor, manhood, all of those things are thought of in Western archetypes, and therefore to see it portrayed in this wild, wild way. And you can think about many other films, I'm not going to bother naming them, but that other films that attempt wild, cartoony humor or attempt to wild surreal quirkiness. We've seen so many abortive attempts at that at film festivals over the years. People who are like, we're influenced by Raising Arizona, and then they add a bunch of weird production design. We've even made some of those movies, but the films don't work, you know, or whatever the thing is. What holds it all together, you know, Holly Hunter's very, very earnest performance, Nicolas Cage's crazy cartoony performance, the wacky lenses, all of that, is that it is speaking to something that is very true. That I don't even... Here's the thing, what I also love. I don't know much about the Coen brothers' personal lives. You know, I know that Joel Coen is married to Frances McDormand for a long time, all the way since back in the day, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, you know that they were going through some version of that experience, mm-hmm. because otherwise, how would they know? They couldn't know that there is a truth as artists that is stitching everything together and giving them wisdom far beyond their years. And I don't know. And that's even more so than the lenses, even more so than the influences, even more so than any of that. It's why the film is still working. The shark is still working all these years later.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. What were you going to say something?
No.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. So, yeah, what have we not talked about in Raising Arizona so far? We've talked about Holly Hunter.
I just as a viewer, and I just wanted to say this because this is our podcast, I did not care for the John Goodman. I like them more this time around, but yeah. I don't like characters that are just meant to annoy the viewer.
Well, I've watched you watch Raising Arizona, and you seem very bothered by, not, you love John Goodman.
I love John Goodman.
But you seem bothered by, and I noticed that you're not bothered by when they're coming out of the ground, and they're all covered in mud, which is, by the way, one of the greatest scenes.
Great. Just yelling for no reason, but keep on yelling, John.
Yep.
Pre-Shawshank Redemption. Escaped by the same method.
Exactly.
And Kevin doing the same thing. Shawshank Redemption ripped that off, man. But serious. But with a serious face on.
They put a serious face on it. It's almost too horrifying when you think... It becomes a horror movie when you think about it. You know, crawling through a sewer pipe for serious, it becomes a Stephen King story. What was the thing? But I have noticed that where it really gets you is, and maybe I'm wrong, but I see the extent to which you strongly identify with Holly Hunter's character of Ed in the movie, and this is your house, and this is your baby, and so
yes!
when they stomp in and put their feet on the coffee table and start to fuck up, they're so precariously...
Get your asses out her house!
Exactly. See?
It's 2 a.m. or whatever the fuck time.
Yes, and that's my point, is I think, in a way, and even you, who are not a man, but a woman, last time I checked, this is that I don't think they would get under your skin unless you fully were right there emotionally with Holly Hunter.
I like them more this time around.
Now, I'm not saying that it's an issue of taste, and if, like, again, them
whatever
eating stuff and weird stuff kind of is off-putting
to
you.
They're
totally
supposed
get
to
it.
Be obnoxious and really always throwing a wrench in
and
the gears.
And good job for them. I think they're obnoxious. Yeah.
And in that sense, and by the way, in that sense, in the way that the film is about either, you know, coming home to being a father after being single and or just growing up and becoming mm-hmm. a father, they represent every aspect of just being wild men, including being little boys, which is why, you know, when she's sitting later on feeding the baby and they're having the conversation about breastfeeding her, you know, they're just eating some cereal with milk at the table the whole time, mm-hmm. like with chewing with their mouths open like they're little boys. So again, it also is a film about high transcending them, you know, childish things and growing up. And you see that tension of just, I love all of the stuff on his face just trying to reconcile the two things. And again, a very relatable scenario, probably for most men who have, let's say, been partying or drinking with their buds and gotten a frustrated call from their wife or girlfriend, can relate to that very same idea, that idea of what is domestication? Is it not being a man anymore? Am I losing something? Blah, blah, blah. And that's exactly what John Goodman says to him. He leans in, wipes his nose, and said, who wears the pants around here, huh? And yet, this is a film about two guys who just got out of prison and a baby that's been kidnapped, and it's in
a
weird Western setting.
You fucking idiot. You're a fucking... I'm sorry.
That's
and that's just the thing. It's like, you're good. He's a good actor. I love John. But it's like, yeah, you fucking idiot. She wears the pants because she's the fucking officer.
Yes, exactly.
You fucking outlaws.
Anyway. And that's what I'm saying, is that...
It pulls some real emotions out of you.
That's what I'm saying. That's that truth. That fucking... It's working. It's obvious. I don't know. William Forsythe as well. Give a shout out to him. He is just as great. And I think,
is he the other guy?
The other guy. Yeah. Yes, the other
guy.
Bless
his heart.
Oh yes. No. Well, I mean, John Goodman is John Goodman, and it's almost mm-hmm. hard. It's hard not to notice John Goodman. He's enormous. But no, William Forsythe is fantastic. And yeah, I don't know. It's
also just a small detail I'm kind of reflecting on the movie. Doesn't Hyde's old boss also have five kids? Like, isn't that like he has multiple
kids?
He has five kids of various ages.
Yep,
but then
that's a good
point. Nathan Jr. is going to be his sixth or whatnot.
That is a good point.
Just a small irrelevant detail, but
mind you, don't cut yourself, Mordecai.
R.I.P. I want a name. I had thrown the idea of a baby name once out as Mordecai.
Yes, I like
the name Mordecai a lot. And I can't imagine for Mordecai.
I know. Taylor ran that by me. She's like, what if we have a boy if we named him Mordecai? On the one hand, the idea of him sounding like some Appalachian banjo player is really appealing to me. But at the same time, I cannot get past, mind you, don't cut yourself, Mordecai.
We have a built-in joke for our son.
There you go. No, that's a good point.
Maybe not the right built-in joke.
I just can't imagine having a boy and calling him Mort or Mordecai or Morty.
Yeah,
it's
Morty.
Just be a bit.
Everyone
thinks
we're just Rick and Morty fans.
Yes, that would be the thing. Well, I guess, you know, it's Raising Arizona. We've hit the high points. If you haven't seen it, go see it. If you get the chance to see it in a theater, please do.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a good theater experience.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a great movie. It's one of those things that we can talk about. You know, why it works as a crazy Chuck Jones cartoon. We could talk about why it works because the Coen brothers are weird and wacky and because the camera's flying all over the place. We could talk about all that, but what I took away this time and continue to take away more each time I see this movie is that what really is in this movie that foreshadows the incredible career, that foreshadows Fargo and No Country for Old Men and the dozens of other masterpieces it feels like they have made. What foreshadows that is the fact that the film is as abstract and weird as it is, and yet still feels so resonant and true on an emotional level. The fact that they were tuned in to meaning, they were tuned in to truth, even if it was only intuitively. I think they were in their like 30s at the time. Even if it was just intuitively tuning in from having seen a lot of movies, they are tuning into something that was true that still seems to resonate with people to this day. And I think that's why A Serious Man works. That's why so many of their weird fucking movies work, is because they actually do have something unique to observe and to say about the world, and they're using the cinematic medium to actually get their unique metaphysical perspective on the world over to an audience in a fun way. You know, like directors used to do a lot back in the days of John Ford and Howard Hawks. They don't do that so much anymore. Or at least those are very few and far between. There's very few and far between to find someone who carries the title of director who has anything to say at all about anything these days. But there they were, Raising Arizona. So, I, of course, do not possess the hubris to believe that I know what this film is about in a true sense, so the only way to discern what the film is actually about is to consult the spirits. Prior to this podcast, I, of course, drew a tarot card asking for what meanings we can take from Raising Arizona that we and our loyal listening audience can take with them into the next week.
Mom.
Exactly. So, Taylor, draw that tarot card and tell us what the card is.
Ooh, it's always reversed when I pull it.
It depends which way you pull it out. But it is the nine. Okay, very, very, very good. This is the nine of wands, which I will hold up right here so that y'all can see it. Boom, look at that. All right, nine of wands. Interesting card for this because, again, the nine of wands, it's the nine is almost to the ten, which is about completion and harvesting. But as you can see, the dude on the nine of wands has a bandage around his head and he is a bit jaded. And has created a fence out of all of his wands, a wall that he does not want to see, that he is defending. And he has a sour expression on his face and a bandage on his head. And which is interesting because the first thing that pops into my head, is to synthesize our discussions of Sam Raimi. This card does synthesize our discussions of Sam Raimi and the Coen brothers for a moment. Because the Coen brothers, not unlike the dude here in the Nine of Wands, I think got a little beaten up and learned a lesson in the only other time after Crime Wave, which we skipped talking about here, but we'll talk about it some other time, that they collaborated with their old buddy Sam Raimi, when a negative, something that came along being beaten up, ultimately led to the harvest, and if you look at the Ten of Wands, you can see the harvest of the Ten of Wands that was the rest of their career. That is to say, and that is our cat letting us know that we've run out of time,
Hi, Mr. Parker.
Hi, Mr. Parker. Pet him.
He's over there?
He's good.
Yeah. Anyway, when they worked, and in fact, I almost want to say, oh, here it is right here. I actually have it right behind me. I didn't even think about this. It was on the Hudsucker Proxy, and I actually have the Hudsucker Proxy screenplay from Half Price Books right here. And as you can see, it says, written by Joel Coen, Ethan Coen, and Sam Raimi, who was also in the movie briefly playing a gangster. And it was the only other time they worked with Sam Raimi, or they collaborated with that fully after that, and it was the Coen brothers' only studio movie, and a film that, despite being another masterpiece and something that was very great, they did not have the full control over that they wanted, did not necessarily have a good experience. I think Don Simpson or something produced it, I am not sure. And after that, they have remained, since that point, independent in their career. That is to say, the Coen brothers are in demand, and they definitely work as screenwriters for Hollywood studios, but they've always raised a lot of their funding for many, many years after that, post-Hudsucker Proxy, that enabled them to make Fargo, that enabled them to make Big Lebowski, that enabled them to basically continue to say the weird shit that they wanted to say. They learned a lesson, became a little bit defensive after getting beaten up, and drew a line in the sand. And it's not talked about often enough, but there is... That's the thing, that's the reason there are no Coen brothers, is because no one anymore, is that no one who gets in Hollywood seems to make that decision, or even realize that there's a decision to be made anymore. It's why every new voice, if you even want to call them that, kind of gets chewed into some sort of machine where they end up directing some form of IP, as that is the only way that they can get a budget for anything, I guess. And so they end up sort of tossing away any kind of perspective or any kind of POV they have, and instead, you know, sacrificing it on the altar of getting a production going. And it's important to remember that when you ask why or how films as singularly great as Fargo and The Big Lebowski, and then later, ultimately, and they continue, I think they worked with studios later on, but films like No Country for Old Men can get made, you realize that there are certain people who actually had the point of view and the balls and the will to sort of learn lessons, walk away from money, and walk away from opportunity to create art out of cinema, to make movies, to make the movies that they had to make, that they needed to make. I'm starting to sound like the guy in The Nine of Wands, a bit beaten up and defensive about cinema and all of that. But truly, you know, to put that out as a challenge to the world, you know, where are the people who have something interesting to say about anything that are under 60 years old and even attempting to make anything right now? Where are they? Where do they exist, Taylor? I haven't seen any lately. What's the deal? What's going on? I don't know.
Yeah, it has been kind of a while since we've seen a new cool movie.
Yes. From like a direct... Maybe I'm just jaded after having seen Mickey 17.
Mickey
17
really did kind of let us down.
Yes, I don't know. Anyway, but Cliff, I feel like I don't even need to ask this question. We already know the answer to this question.
Naturally.
The last thing we have left to do on this podcast is award the Full Metal Jacked Award to the most jacked person in Raising Arizona. So, Cliff, who is the most jacked person in Raising Arizona?
As backstory for this character, I can say that I first encountered this movie not at 13, but as like 4 or 5 years old, mm-hmm. when it was on HBO or something, a new-ish release. Mm-hmm. I think my dad was watching it or something. Mm-hmm. I was watching along. Only thing I remember from watching it then was the biker, obviously. And I do remember also Dad had to explain the pin on the grenade, how that worked out. That was my first conceptualization of a grenade and how they worked.
Nice.
And from then on, I thought only about having grenades and blowing stuff up. I would never be a complete man until I had just a vest full of grenades I could randomly toss at stuff.
Yes, that's why you have that's, and that's if you go look at his grenade vest closet, that's what made him the man he is today.
Exactamundo. And
grenade vests were huge, by the way, in the 90s. I guess it was the late 80s, but we just saw Demon Knight at the last 35mm print of Demon Knight the other day, and that also had a grenade vest. Grenade vests were big back then because of Rambo or something, probably.
Oh, yeah. And I can say this. Randall Tex Cobb obviously wins the Full Metal Jacked Award. A tough guy, extraordinaire in a bunch of movies, role mostly cut from Liar Liar. Kickboxing champion, not just a boxing champion, kickboxing champion. You see him do that spin kick amongst the other ways he's beating up Nicolas Cage.
Was he in Liar Liar? He's in Ace Ventura. Is he in Liar Liar as well?
Wasn't he the criminal that was being mostly in cut scenes.
I'd like
he
to think
pops
that
in there briefly.
I'd like to think that Randall Tex Cobb and Jim Carrey just remained friends for years and years. Randall Tex Cobb was a martial artist, wasn't he? And we also saw him in Golden Child, was the other big
Golden Child, obviously.
We watched Golden Child a shit ton. Oh man, we almost got the chance to see Golden Child in the theater. Wasn't it playing? I feel like it was playing somewhere and we missed a screening of it. At some point we will go see Golden Child again, or we will see Golden Child in the theater and come talk about it, because that also shows off his range. What's amazing is he's so good in the scene with Nathan Arizona in the office. He's just great in that scene. And if you
despite his weird wheezy voice from his many times broken nose and all that stuff.
Yes, it is painful to hear his voice now, knowing, because clearly he can't breathe through his nose at all, and realizing like the amount of complications medically it causes when you can't breathe through your nose is why they fix that these days. But at the same time, if he didn't have that completely flattened nose from his martial arts career that was just literally like a silver dollar, super glued to Voldemort's face, basically, is what that looks like. It's a disc. If he didn't have that completely closed nose, he wouldn't be Randall Tex Cobb, and he wouldn't have that face. But when we see The Golden Child, which we will see at some point, which is Axel Foley versus demons, The Golden Child is my favorite Beverly Hills Cop movie by far. And
I'm just glad I immediately recognized the name Axel Foley.
There you go. You did. See, you've seen all those movies now. But Beverly, so Golden Child, it's the best Beverly Hills Cop movie. Axel Foley fights demons, and
is it Eddie Murphy?
Well, he's basically
is Eddie Murphy. It's not Axel Foley, sure, technically, sure. But he plays it as Axel Foley versus demons.
Yeah, that was apparently we'll give the 10-second version of this story. I suppose we're wrapping up, but yes, it was originally going to be a movie where Eddie Murphy was going to play more of a straight lead, and it was going to take. It was about Tibetan demons and a basically little Dalai Lama kid that gets kidnapped. By this demon. Fantasy action, very much like Big Trouble in Little China in a lot of ways. However, when audiences went to go see it, apparently test audiences just didn't understand why Eddie Murphy wasn't acting like Eddie Murphy and saying wacky Eddie Murphy things.
Wanted to be on, you're like, he's going to play a straight man. I was like, why?
Yes. So apparently wacky Eddie Murphy things, they wanted to see that. And Charles Dance from Game of Thrones, Tyrion Lannister, who was the villain in that movie and Last Action Hero and stuff.
We're not Tyrion, it's Papa Lannister. Tywin, some other weird tea name.
Papa Lannister.
Dies on the shitter.
Yes, there you go. He was the villain in those scenes. So they literally reshot scenes, like the airport scene and my dear sweet brother Numsi, just reshot a bunch of scenes and just had Eddie Murphy just do Axel Foley. He's just doing Axel Foley. He's playing Axel Foley. He's handling situations in an improvisatory way.
The wonderful thing is you can see that it's supposed to be annoying to the character of the Sado Numspa, the demon. Yeah. Clearly annoying as well to the actor playing.
Yes, Dan, that's what Charles Dance said was basically, he said it was, and he just said, I remember reading in an interview, he said it was kind of a shame because he said it was going to be a movie where Eddie Moot was going to get to do something different, and then they basically just had us come back and reshoot scenes where he was Axel Foley. And so a lot of scenes where Charles Dance is sort of standing there while Eddie Murphy kind of just does Axel Foley shit around him, which again, I love, and it's why we watch the movie, and who knows, we probably wouldn't have watched the movie a million fucking times.
I think that was the right note.
It was probably the right note. Fun fact of history is apparently if you do want to get more of an insight into what the original script was for the film, the original vision for the movie, there was a novelization that was commissioned for Golden Child prior to the shooting and the reshooting of the movie, and the novelization, it tells the story that the movie was originally supposed to be. But still a great movie, and quite frankly what makes the Golden Child work so well is that it is that mixture of crazy Axel Foley fights demons, but the reason we're talking about all of this is that the little Dalai Lama boy gets kidnapped by Charles Dance, Sardo Numspa, and his weird gang of crazy dudes, and then the boy enchants one of the goons that is played by Randall Tex Cobb, who has like a child's mind but is very strong, and then he ends up like defending the little boy and trying to help him and stuff like that, and you see him basically playing this like weird like anyway, he's good in that movie too, is what saying. So, Golden Woot. Child, check it out.
Woot.
Yes. So I guess we've said everything we need to say about Golden Child. So I think we can wrap up our Raising Arizona podcast. All right, guys. This was a fun one. And stuff.
Had a lot of fun notes.
Yeah, and hopefully we have some cool stuff we see coming up, screening in the air. I think we have. Well, hopefully we'll get to it. I think Silence of the Lambs is coming up. Fantastic Planet is screening soon. Mm-hmm. Because
Fantastic Planet is one that you've seen before. You've been really hyping up to me.
Yeah, I've seen it before. I think you would like it because it's an animated thing. I haven't seen it in a long time. I'm very curious. It is one of those films because it's French and animated that, not unlike Miyazaki, plays like every 6 months at every Indian repertory theater around the country. So if we don't catch Fantastic Planet this time, we'll catch it 6 months from now when it plays again. But Silence of the Lambs is coming up. That would be really cool to see. So hopefully we'll see some of those. Anyway, until next time. thanks for joining us this week. Until next week, everybody, I am Kyle.
I am Taylor.
And I am Cliff.
And we will see y'all in a crowded theater.
Woo! One for Taylor.